There's a sequence that we can begin to see in the spiritual journey that goes from the moment of awakening to the predicament that you've gotten caught in an imbalance, you've gotten caught in your separateness, and the attempt to come back into the unity of all things. And then you see that there is the completion of the circle where you come back into your uniqueness, but you're not caught in it, and that you are both one with everything and separate. And there are a lot of stages in the spiritual journey which at first are sequential and later become almost simultaneous, and in fact do become simultaneous, where you are both in the world and not in the world. It's both perfect and it stinks. You are both one with everything, and you're also unique and separate. What this represents, of course, is that you are acknowledging that you exist on more than one plane of reality simultaneously. And this is particularly apparent when you meet another person. When you're practicing that balancing, you realize that you meet in, quote, relationship. That means that there's two. And when you are seeing that relationship as part of the spiritual journey, you are, at the same moment you're relating to the other person as a separate entity in a relational way, you are looking through that process to the place where there's only one of us that appear to be two. And that one of us isn't an us, it's an awareness. It's awareness. When you look at spiritual practices, most of the practices are designed to awaken you out of separateness into the connection to all things, to the Spirit, to God, to the One. Now, the different strategies for working on oneself to awaken to that unity that lies behind the diversity, to that spacious awareness that lies behind the form, the nibbana that is the other side of the balance of the samsara, whichever way you want to present this, is determined by your karmic predilections. For example, some people are very quiet and reflective. And for them, the path may well be the path, say, of meditation, like a Theravada meditation. I've done that for maybe 20 years. And it seems bizarre when my rational intellectual mind examines what I do in that meditation practice, that I spend hours and, in fact, sometimes months just sitting, following the rising and falling of the muscle in my abdomen that goes with each breath, and bringing my mind down to one point like a laser beam and letting go of its identification with other thought, bringing it always back to the center, just like a flower where you go out into the petal and come back to the center, out into the petal, come back to the center, out into thought, out into sensation, come back to the center, come back to the center, come back to the center. And that practice allows you finally to extricate yourself from identification with thoughts. Doesn't stop the thoughts. They're like a river that's going by all the time. It's just that instead of each thought taking you, you stay quiet in the center. And when the mind gets really concentrated, it penetrates, and you penetrate into the realm where you are not separate from anything. That is a strategy. The end point of that is not to leave you being a meditator, but to be free. And it's important that you recognize, even as you embrace the technique, that every technique is a trap. Every single one of them. But the tricky thing about meditative practices is you have to be trapped by them for them to work. So you go into it knowing it's a trap with the trust that as it works, it will self-destruct. Now, there's a subtle issue in that when you get into what is called devotional or bhakti yoga. These are all different forms of yoga or coming into yoga or union or the one. And these are all different strategies to go up the mountain depending on your unique predispositions. Some people lead with their hearts very strongly, and for them, bhakti or devotional yoga is such a delicious path. What that path is that of seeing the beloved and honoring and worshiping and loving and singing to and following the path of being in the presence of the beloved. And when bhakti yoga gets really working, you are so intimate with the beloved that you are at the edge of where the foreplay ends and the merging occurs. But you see, for a bhakti, that's a moment when they don't want to go into the one, because then you lose the beloved. So there's a point for the bhakti where they come right up to the edge and then they actually push against God, or they push against the one in order to stay in the lover-beloved relationship of the two. This has to do with dualism and non-dualism. Because the bhakti, just like the meditative, the dhyana yoga form, the bhakti form, as you do it, and your love becomes more and more one-pointed, and you're with the beloved more and more, less and less are you busy being separate. You are just so tuned to the beloved, and you just keep opening and opening and opening to it, and finally you merge into the beloved. I can feel that my path of Guru Kripa, grace of the Guru, is a devotional path. And as I love Maharaji more and more and more and more and ever more and ever more and way beyond what I ever thought I could love any being or any idea or anything, and my heart just keeps opening to it and deeper and more pure love and more unattached love and more, I can feel the merging. I can feel things happening inside of me, as well as forms. I remember once in a Kosani in India, doing a fast for a number of days, and during that period, I started out with pictures of all Anandamayi Ma, who's one of the great, great women, great saints of all time, beautiful, beautiful being. She was such an example of bhakti yoga, of devotional yoga. She loved Bhagwan, or God, so much. And she just stayed right at the fine line between merging and non-merging. And she was always seeing her beloved and singing to her beloved. I had her darshan twice. I was in her presence twice. Once there were only about five of us, and she just came out of a room and stood quietly while I touched her feet and just felt her presence and then walked on as if she was sleepwalking. And the other time she was sitting with thousands of people, and they were just sitting there. She brought them right to the edge of that place, and all she was doing was she was singing to her beloved. Jaya Bhagwan, Jaya Bhagwan, Jaya Bhagwan, Jaya Bhagwan, Jaya Bhagwan. Jaya Bhagwan, Jaya Bhagwan, Jaya Bhagwan, Jaya Bhagwan, Jaya Bhagwan, Jaya Bhagwan, Jaya Bhagwan. And she just sang that for maybe 10,000 people were just in that intimate space. It was like pillow talk. It was so incredibly sweet. So at first I had all these pictures out, and I'd look at them and I'd love them. And then as I got quieter inside, the pictures all seemed just like paper and pictures and stuff. And I took them and I folded them up and put them away. And I started to feel the presence of these beings around me, and it was like I was bathing in love with them. And then one morning I woke up and they weren't there. And I felt I had fallen from grace. I felt now they found me out and they left. And I was feeling that emptiness and that horror. And after I got over my panic and started to meditate, I started to feel this warmth inside myself. And I realized that they were coming inside of me. And that I was starting to experience the merging with the beloved. And then after 5 days, when the fast was over, I went out and started to eat and talk to people, and then pretty soon it was outside, and then I put up the pictures again. But the form of devotion is so incredibly sweet. So incredibly sweet. I hesitate to tell this story because it's my oldest, goldenest story. Some of you already know what it's going to be. But I can't resist. I just can't resist. I love it so much. In 1970, or mid-70s, I guess, I was driving across the country in an old Buick limousine that I had, that I had made into a camper. It's a big black 38 limousine. I had just set out from Boston for California, and I knew I had 2 weeks ahead of me of driving this 6,000-pound car. It was just lovely. And I had one leg up under me, and I was on the New York Thruway, and I was saying the names of God. And different names at different times on the journey, but at this point I was saying the name of Krishna. Krishna, at a certain stage, was this teenage youth that was blue in color. And everybody just fell in love with him the minute they saw him. So I was doing Krishna, Krishna, Hare Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. And I just kept enough consciousness to keep the steering wheel on the road, and I just looked forward to 2 weeks of singing to God and driving across. See, are you driving across the country or are you singing to God? Which one are you doing? So I was singing to God, and I was in quite an ecstatic state, and I looked into my rearview mirror, and there was this blue light. Okay. And the first thought was, he's come. Okay. But, of course, I also realized, because there was enough of me down, that this was a state trooper. So I pulled the car over, and this being came up to the window. And he said, "May I see your license and registration?" Now, in the state of mind I was in, see, what I thought was, my God, he's come. He's come as a state trooper. I mean, after all, Christ came as a carpenter. How do you know how in the 70s Krishna would come? Why not a state trooper? So, sure, you want my license and registration? Take my life. What do you want? You know, of course. So I gave him my license and registration. I'm looking at him with such love. You know, I mean,
Can you imagine having the darshan of God? He just comes up to the window and says, you know, can I see a license and registration? So he walks around the car and he goes back and he calls home or whatever he does on his radio. And then he came back and he said, well, what's in that box on the seat? And I said, they're mints. Would you like one? And I mean, what I was trying to do was stall. I just wanted him there as long as I possibly could have him. See, I'm just loving him. And he said, you were driving too slowly on the thruway, you'll have to drive on an ancillary road if you're going to drive this slow. And he said, I understand it's an old car. And then he finished, he decided not to give me a ticket, and then that routine was over. Now, see, we meet in the role of state trooper and miscreant, or potential miscreant, and then we run through that one, and then what do? Because the predicament he felt was that he wasn't used to being loved that way. I mean, when a state trooper stops people, they don't usually look at him with unconditional love, you know? And he didn't want to go away, but he didn't know what else to do. I mean, it's a tricky thing. So he said, great car you got there. See, which was, that allowed us, I could get out of the car, we could kick and spit and kick the tires and say, it's a straight eight when they don't make them like they used to. And, things like that. And he could tell me old car stories and I could tell him old car stories. And then we ran out of that one. And I mean, I didn't care. I had the rest of my life, you know, with the presence of this being. And then he said, well, be gone with you. Well, now, that isn't state trooper talk, you know, I mean. But I learned from the 60s that you don't blow your cover. I mean, if he wants to be a state trooper, you be a citizen. That's the part you play. So I said, thank you, officer. And I got in my car and I shifted down. I started to drive away and I looked in my rearview mirror and he walked back to his cruiser and he was waving at me. And I thought, oh, come on, state troopers don't wave. He blew his cover. Now, I began to reflect about who I didn't see as God and why. Instead of, wasn't it wonderful that I saw him as God? Who don't I see as God and why don't I? I mean, aren't you all God in drag? No. I mean, aren't these the many faces of the Beloved, all just different masks of it, different forms? You hearing the form of devotional yoga,
because that's it, that's the one. You come to the one through the heart, through the love, through the love, through seeing the Beloved.
Then there's another form that is appropriate for some people. There are some people that have very evolved intellects, and they work exquisitely with intellect. And for them, they are attracted to techniques where the mind beats the mind. Where you get it like the koan, the Zen koan.
It's something where your rational mind can't solve it. And you're constantly pushed beyond it until you break through into that which is beyond thinking, because the thinking mind always stays in dualism. It always thinks about something. It's always thinking about an object. And you go beyond the separation of thought and object, of thinker and object. Like Zen master Yasutani, our true nature is beyond all categories. Whatever you can conceive or imagine is but a fragment of yourself. Hence, the real you cannot be found through logical deduction or intellectual analysis or endless imagining. Here's one that shows you the process of watching thought and then watching the watcher of thought and going back inward.
When the mind gazes into the mind itself, the train of discursive and conceptual thought ends, and supreme enlightenment is gained. These are all techniques. Like Kalu Rinpoche, who was one of my wonderful, wonderful mentors, a great and wonderful teacher. He said, we live in illusion, the appearance of things. But there is a reality. We are that reality. When you understand this, you see that you're nothing. And being nothing, you're everything. That's all there is. Now, see how the mind, most minds say, oh, I don't understand that. But take it, if you take your mind and play with that one, just work with it. We live in illusion, the appearance of things, but there is a reality. We are that reality, but it's not an appearance. It's not a thing. When you understand this, you see you're nothing. Being nothing, you're everything. That's all. One of my favorites, the Sun Tzu Ming, the third Chinese patriarch of Zen, can absolutely drive up the wall. I mean, those of you that like playing with your mind, this will do it to you. Just take the first line. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Isn't that fun? I want to follow the great way. Is that a preference? And later on it says, even to be attached to enlightenment is to go astray.
You take this as a tract and you just every day
study this. And you say, how is it possible to have opinions without having opinions? How can I do that? How can I function in the world of preferences and opinions without having them? Who would that be? You see how you're playing with the mind, you're constantly pushing the mind against itself.
This is exactly what Talmudic scholars do. So in Buddhism, it's the Zen koan. It's a whole set of strategies of pitting the mind against the mind. It's called Jnana Yoga, J-N-A-N-A, Jnana Yoga. The mind beats the mind. And the other tract, which I think is one of the highest tracts I've also found, I wanted to share those two very high tracts with you, is Dujum Rinpoche, which is really Dzogchen, a form of Tibetan Buddhism. And it's a form of, he's talking to monks who are going into deep meditation, and he's telling them how not to get caught in their minds and how to do it. Now, some of you say, yeah, that's for me. Some of you say, I really like bhakti or devotional yoga. Some of you say, I really like to meditate. But then, some of you are very, what in India would call rajasic, very active. You move a lot. You've got a lot of fire energy, and you like to do things. And to sit still in a meditation absolutely drives you up the wall. And the minute you get into this thing of good people meditate, you know, you really do yourself in. And for those people, the best thing is to find forms that work with energy. Tai Chi is a very gentle meditative process that works with meditation and movement. Many people find the mind going beyond its own separateness through running. Then there are things that work directly with the energies. This is all part of Hatha Yoga, specifically the Kundalini, the energies, the breath, the prana or Shakti.
where you take in breath and you retain it and close various parts of your body. Then, while holding the breath, you focus on the bottom of the spine, where you tap on the bottom of the spine with your mind. And this thing starts to happen, which is known as the awakening of Mother Kundalini. And it absolutely is this energy that explodes, that goes up through you, what's called the Sushumna, and meets, and at each chakra or energy center, it comes through that, and if that's open, it keeps right on going. If that's not open, it comes out. When I was with Swami Muktananda, he used to focus his awareness in such a way that he would arise, awaken Kundalini in people by focusing on that energy in them. And the energy would start up, and then wherever it was blocked, it would come out in some what appeared to be strange behavior. At one point, when we were with him in Melbourne, Australia, and there were maybe 20 people in the room. In Melbourne, older, more conservative people come to see holy beings. It's sort of like the occult is a big thing in Australia. And so they came for lunch hour to see the Swami. The Swami was there with his orange hat and his shades. He looked like a Thelonious monk, and he was sitting there playing his dotara in the darkening room and the roses on the trellis. It was like Boston in the 1940s. It was great. It's modern. And he was strumming his dotara. And suddenly this portly gentleman in a dark blue suit with a watch fob started to do these intricate mudras, movements with his hand in very formalized forms that you recognize from statues you'd seen. But the look on his face was one of complete consternation that he wasn't doing them. And then there was a man next to him in a tweed jacket with a pipe in his pocket. And as Muktananda just kept playing the dotara, this man stood up and started to do this very incredible dancing. With no appreciation, I mean, he didn't know what was happening to him. It was like you get a tick or something like that. And then a woman had come who was the secretary to one of the people, and she just came out of curiosity for her lunch hour. She was sitting cross-legged, and she started to bounce across the floor. And I, at one moment, I looked, and the whole place was like the back ward of a mental hospital. It was all these kind of weird experiences, and everybody had this look. Nobody knew what was going on. And then when it got a little too outrageous, he just would change the rhythm a little bit, and it would all stop. Now, that's working with the energies. I had a woman call me from Berkeley some years back, and she said, I'm a therapist in Berkeley, and I am about to commit myself to a mental hospital. She said, because I've got this energy, I don't know what's happening to me. She said, I'm driving my bicycle 6 hours a day at full speed. I can't sleep. I start crying unpredictably. I'm reciting poetry. I find myself in these odd postures. And she said, I'm going crazy. And she described a list of about six things. And I said, just a minute. And I went to my file, and I had a ditto, a Xerox, of 22 signs of Mother Kundalini that Swami Muktananda had put out. So I said to her, let me read you this Xerox list. You mean it's a Xerox list? And then she didn't go crazy, as we all are. She was coming uncrazy. Now, what that does, what happens is the energy comes up, and where it hits, it comes out in a specific form that is appropriate to that chakra.
And that's all interesting. It's also kind of spiritual materialism. It's wonderful. It's a nice hit and a rush. But you have to keep working with your mind and your heart to make that all open up so that the energy goes all the way up to the thousand petal lotus at the top of the head, the seventh chakra, and then goes out through. Okay, so there's another form. Then there's Tantra, working with the senses to go beyond the senses. The mala is a tantric form. Mudras are a tantric form. Yantra, mandalas are a tantric form. These are all forms where you work with the sense data and then go beyond it. You go through it, beyond it. So you see there are these many, many forms, all of which take you out of your separateness into the awareness or the oneness or something, and then not so that you end up staying there, but so that you get it back into balance, so you are both in your separateness and not in your separateness. That's the ultimate place of the spiritual path. But all these practices, since most of us are so stuck in separateness, they're designed to bring us back into the one behind the many.
This is the end of side 4. Please fast forward the tape to the end to cue up side 3 for your next listening.